Okay, good afternoon. So last time we talked about there's my window. Okay, last time we talked about race conditions, and then we went into talking a bit about what sort of operations are atomic, because we thought like we had kind of an intuition that like we do one thing and then that swap between other threads, but we learned that, well, you know, some things we think of as one operation actually are done in pieces, and this affects what results are possible. And this meant that kind of just doing the kind of intuitive thing of thinking of what order could these happen in, you know, didn't actually tell us all the possible results. And we had a further problem that when we were accessing memory, our compilers and our processors said, oh gosh, you know, we don't really need to, you know, do the sort of loads and stores in order, we can move them around. Because both the compiler and, it turns out, sometimes the processor do these optimizations where they say, you know, we really should just load this value once in advance and, you know, just keep it there rather than like loading it every time. And this can affect the results we see with multiple cores and multiple threads. Because the compiler and processor are kind of assuming that the code we've written is designed only for a single thread, you know, just a choice they've made that it's not worth considering the possibility of other threads doing things all the time. And our solution for this is that things like our threading library would provide us tools that would let us coordinate between threads, which would, among other things, tell the compiler and the processor, hey, there's other threads doing stuff here, please, you know, don't mess that up. And we mentioned that pthread create and pthread join were among functions that did this. That when we create a thread, the pthreads library, in addition to actually creating a thread, is going to do the work to tell the compiler and the processor that, hey, you know, all the values I wrote before creating the thread, those actually need to be written. You can't pretend there's not another thread around. And for pthread join, you're like, all the values I'm reading after the join, those actually need to be read after the join. You have to assume another thread's doing something up until the join finishes. Please don't mess this up by deciding, oh, I can just load that into a register earlier. No, not acceptable. But pthread create and pthread join, you mentioned, like kind of were very coarse-grained tools and didn't give us the ability to coordinate threads in many cases that we were interested in when we were looking at our kind of race condition type examples. We're like thinking about we have an imbalance, we want to update for multiple threads, the sort of start and stop a whole thread, not the right tool for it. So we have this new abstraction we called locks, which are for threads that need to take turns. So this tool gave us a way to have threads take turns, and typically our pattern is we have a lock for each resource, and we acquire the lock to wait for our turn to use that resource and release it to give some other thread a turn if it wants one. And then we briefly talked about a different synchronization construct, one that you'll use in an upcoming assignment called barriers. And the idea of barriers is that we want to have multiple threads work in lockstep. And this didn't really make sense for our kind of account deposit example, where kind of the point of having multiple threads is that they would be doing rather different things. But it is a very common pattern when we're thinking about our parallelism application, where we have one big task we want to do, like a big simulation, and we could kind of straightforwardly do that with one thread, but it would be too slow. So we split it up among multiple threads, but, you know, we have these time steps where we like compute, you know, the result for time zero and use that to compute the result for time one. And we need all the other thread stuff potentially, or at least a bunch of other thread stuff. So it's useful to have all the threads do step zero, then do step one, then do step two, and barriers are exactly a tool to help out with that pattern. So questions about things we covered last time, and we'll go through a barrier exercise we didn't do as our to review barriers first thing today. Okay, so note on the quiz. On quiz question one, I realized, I messed up. J plus equals one should have been what I intended to write, but I left it as J plus equals four. And I looked, these things should still generally increase. I didn't think through actually doing the analysis and realizing they stay the same. They don't get, but it just happens in that special case that some of the numbers of cache misses would stay the same because we didn't hit the case where we had multiple accesses to the same block without the J plus equals one. And I didn't actually do that analysis when I looked at what's the effect of this. I just said, that doesn't really change the general pattern, and that was a mistake on my part, so I dropped two options on the queue. Okay, so let's get to our barrier exercise. So I have some code here that uses barriers. Question is, what's the output? Can you work through, figure out what is our output? There is one place where we're going to write the output. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who can give me one possibility? Yeah. What do you got? 50, 30. Okay. Any other possibilities? Who thinks that 50-30 is the only possibility? No clue? Okay, mostly consensus. So I think 50-30 is the only possibility. And the way I think about this example is that we can kind of pair up the calls to barrier wait. So everything before the first call happens in some arbitrary order. So we have what I've labeled as kind of 1A and 1B here, assigning to Y and assigning to X are happening at the same time. X and Y are separate variables, and we said we're going to assume like assigning to different things, they're actually separate. And so that's going to end up with, when we get to this first wait, both of the threads are going to be there together. They're going to have to do that before they proceed. And we'll have X is 10 and Y, sorry, other way around. X is 20 and Y is 10. Then we're going to sync up at the next barrier wait here. So thread 2, not going to do anything in that between those two calls, and that's perfectly fine. It's allowed to do that. And we're going to do kind of our step two, is we're gonna do y equals x plus y. So y is gonna go from 10 to 30. And then we have our next barrier weight call. Here. So we're going to have our step three, and while that's happening, our thread one is not going to do anything between calls. That's perfectly fine. And we're going to set x equals x plus y. That's going to be 50. And that's definitely going to happen before we run the printf, because the barrier weight in thread one prevents the printf from running until thread two is done with the assignment to x. And this guarantees that we don't have any race conditions, because we're making sure we're not reading something while it's being written in any case. So questions? Solution. Okay. Yes. Question, once all threads catch up to your barrier, it's fine to reuse it? Yes, and this is part of why you need to say how many threads there are. And when we say catch up, like, internally, the barrier needs to deal with the fact that, for example, it might be the case that this thread is still returning from barrier wait while we're making this barrier call. It has to handle that scenario, and it's going to do enough bookkeeping to figure that out somehow. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question back there? Other questions? Okay. So if you look in the schedule, we have an upcoming homework called Life in a couple weeks, where we start out with a kind of simulation scenario where we have a grid. I'll do this. We have a two grid that is going to be set based on compute value from grid, and we're going to kind of set it element by element. So we're going to have lots of calls to compute value to set different parts of the grid. I should probably have drawn that in a different place for consistency. But so basically, we're going to take our from grid and use it to compute our to grid. And we are going to give you this non-multi-threaded code. And kind of our goal is that different parts of the to grid can be computed from different threads, because they're only reading the from grid. And then the code we give you does this swap. And you might say, why are we doing this swap? Well, we're doing this as kind of, you know, we're doing something like from grid gets to grid, and to grid sort of a new grid is conceptually what we want to do. But we don't want to keep reallocating a new grid, so instead we do a swap, and this is, you know, to allocate sort of new memory each time. And the swap is done with just pointers. Pointers, and that's why it's efficient. We aren't actually copying one to the other. The goal of this is that for our next step, we want to turn the two grid into a from and make a new two grid. But the way we'll do that is by kind of just relabeling this from grid as two grid and shuffling things around. And the reason why the swap is efficient is because it's not actually copying things, it's just shuffling pointers around. questions on this sort of what? How this simulation code works. And your goal is going to be to parallelize this. So basically have the two grid be computed by multiple threads at the same time. And to do that, you know, we're going to have to synchronize. And that's why we're teaching barriers. It's like it's a perfect fit for this kind of problem. Questions on our life homework preview? Okay, so our main topic today, we're going to talk about deadlock. And I'll start with kind of a, you know, real world analogy. So let's say we have a one-way bridge. And when we talked about doing locks, we said the way we're going to resolve conflicts with a shared resource, like this one-way bridge here, is that we're going to reserve resources to take turns using something like a lock. So my strategy, you know, might be that, you know, if we want to coordinate crossing this bridge, we'll just say, okay, before you go forward in the yellow car, we better just make sure that we reserve, make sure no one else is using the road right ahead, and we'll do the same in the black car. So we just make sure that we have exclusive access to the road right ahead of us before we go there. You know, kind of like what we were doing with locks, make sure we're the only ones taking a turn with that piece of the road, and go there. And then we do the same. We just say, okay, so we're just going to make sure we have exclusive access to the road ahead here before we go ahead. The same thing in the black car. Just going to wait until we have exclusive access, and we've successfully avoided a crash. We also are going to be waiting here forever unless someone gives up. And in the real world, you know, what would happen is that you'd realize that we're in a situation where someone needs to back up. You know, we can't just wait forever, look, stare in front of us and say, you yellow car, you have to move. You know, someone needs to actually give up. We can't just have staring range. But the way our locks work, when we call something like mutex lock, we are engaging in this staring match. We are saying, I'm going to wait until you have that resource available for me. I don't care how long it takes. I'm just waiting. I'm not going to do anything else while I'm waiting. That's how mutex lock works. So this kind of ridiculous, we're just at an impasse because everyone refuses to give up. Well, our code using locks is going to be exactly this stubborn. And we can accidentally get in this sort of situation, you know, with kind of real natural code you might write. And an annoying thing about this is that this like depended on the timing being exactly right, right? If either of these cars had arrived at slightly different times, everything would be fine. When the timing is exactly right, we get to this impasse here where, you know, someone needs to grid it back up, and if we don't ever do that, well, we're just stuck. So you might say, well, this is like a contrived situation. How could this happen with kind of normal code? So I'll show an example with, I think, normal looking code. So let's say we're representing a file system in memory, and the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to have my directories represented with a hash table, and I want to make sure that, you know, we take turns accessing the hash table because it would be kind of really bad if we have two threads writing to the same bucket in the hash table, or we resize the hash table and one thread is accessing the unresized version after it's supposed to be resized. So we're going to use a lock to make sure all that stuff doesn't happen, and we take turns accessing the hash table. And here I have a function to move a file from one directory to another. And to do that, well, I want to make sure that when I'm manipulating these two hash tables, you know, we have our turn to access them. And I want to do this anyways because I don't want it to be the case that someone can like see the file in two directories at once. I want to avoid that from happening, and this prevents that, right? People accessing our fromdir or our todir are either going to see the file is there or not there. They're not going to see any sort of state where it's in both places. But we have a problem here that we can have these two kind of conceptually independent move operations, where I'm moving foo from A to B and bar from B to A. And if I do these at the same time, I can end up with that same sort of everyone's waiting for everyone else situation, which we're going to call a deadlock. And as I mentioned with the car situation, like most of the time when we test this, this will actually work out fine. That often it will be the case that, you know, we'll do one move, then we'll do the other, and they won't coincide. So in fact, the lock like won't change anything. And sometimes, even when the lock does change sort of how the threads run, we'll be fine. So in this example, thread one locks directories A and B, and then thread two tries to lock B. We're fine, actually, because thread two is going to wait for thread one to be finished. Thread one releases the lock on B. Thread two gets it. Then it waits for the A lock, and that might seem like we might have a problem, but it's okay, because thread one is not going to be waiting. It's going to actually give up the resource. So thread two manages to act normally, and we have no problem. The issue is that very occasionally we'll get unlucky. And we'll have thread one lock A and thread two lock B, you know, just fast enough such that when thread one tries to lock B and thread two tries to lock A, they're at the same impasse. That thread one is waiting for thread two to release the lock on B so it can make progress. And thread two is not gonna do that because it's waiting for thread one to release the lock on A. And we didn't write any code that does anything but keep this standoff going. So it's gonna just hang our program. And all the code afterwards that's supposed to actually move these files will never get to run. You know, probably we'll, you know, have to like restart the application or reboot the system to resolve the situation. And kind of annoyingly, you know, if we're thinking of like testing for this, this is gonna be something which, you know, only happens very occasionally. It's gonna be hard to reproduce. You know, so this is the kind of bug where your bug report is, you know, it works well for a couple weeks and then it hangs. And because of that, we're going to talk later on about fixing the situation by sort of finding ways of kind of preventing these from happening, preventing these deadlock situations from happening. Before I get to that, we're going to look at kind of understanding exactly what can cause these types of situations, you know, because this is not the only example of scenarios which can result in this sort of standoff, this deadlock scenario. And something which is helpful for thinking about that is I can draw this kind of diagram here, where what I'm going to do is I'm going to represent my threads with these ovals, and I'm going to represent what the thread is waiting for with an arrow from the thread to something else. And I'm going to represent a resource that the thread holds and needs to give up sometime later with an arrow from that resource to something, to the thread. And my resources, which in this case were directory locks, I'm going to represent with squares or rectangles, I should say. And when I say directory B, I really mean directory B's lock, but you know, I'm just writing that for shorthand. And the problem here is that we have this circular waiting situation, and there's no way of resolving this unless one of these links can go away. And the way our code works for thread one and thread two, there's nothing to make that happen. So once we get in this situation, we're stuck. And a kind of naive solution for this deadlock is you might say, okay, well, we just need to detect when we have a call AB and BA, right? We just need to look for that. Yeah, just somehow detect when there's these two calls that kind of match up like that. And that would prevent this deadlock, but it doesn't prevent the move file function from causing deadlocks because we can have a more complicated version of this situation. So here I have three threads, and no two of the threads are share both of the things they're working on. But I can have it be the case that directory A is doing a move from A to B, and so, or doing a move, sorry, thread one is doing a move from A to B, so it has the lock for A and is waiting for the lock for B. Thread two isn't moving from B to A, it's moving from B to C, which seems fine, and it would be fine, except that there's another thread moving from C to A. So we can have this deadlock scenario not involve a standoff between two threads, but in this case, three and up to an arbitrarily large number of threads. And obviously our bad luck needs to be worse to like kind of trigger the more thread scenario, but again, this is going to be the kind of thing where the way it will often manifest is like every few weeks that the application hangs. And to give maybe a possibly nicer diagram of what would be going on our situation. We have our three conceptually unrelated move file calls, except there's just some directories in common. Questions on my deadlock with three threads? Okay. So when I've been introducing deadlock, I've been saying this has a thing with locks, and that's deliberate because locks are the most common way we can do this, but we can have this kind of problem with any resource, not just with locks. So as an example, let's say instead of having the malloc interface, so malloc is allocate or fail, right? Instead of doing that, we said, well, you know, my system's running a bunch of these kind of temporary things that use a bit of memory for a while and then go away. So let's implement this allocate or wait for, right? To manage my limited memory, you know, we'll just have when you want to do something with a lot of memory, you know, eventually that will free up because I'm running a bunch of things that use a bunch of memory and then stop. And you can see here, I'm running things that use a bunch of memory, then give up the memory. So it seems like we might be able to have this other memory allocation interface where we either allocate the memory now, but rather than returning an old pointer and like crashing or, you know, printing an error like we traditionally do with malloc, we'll just have it wait for the memory to be available. And this kind of illustrates why we don't have that memory interface. That I can have a scenario here where if I have 2 megs of memory, I can run thread one, I can run thread two, and they work fine. And I can also run kind of both of them, and usually it will be the case that they'll wait for each other, that if thread one's doing its calculation and I start thread two, it's gonna start wait for thread one to give up some memory before it makes any progress. But that's fine because it's gonna get to run after thread one, which is probably what we intended to do by having this allocate or wait for idea. But we can end up with a scenario where if they kind of run in, you know, at just the right timing, they're both asking for 1 megabyte more memory, and they're not gonna get it till the other gives up their memory. So this is an example of another deadlock, but this one doesn't involve locks, just involves some other resource that we wait for. So the key thing that lets us have this deadlock scenario is that we can have the standoff, and the standoff involves we have a resource, we're waiting for another. And this allocator wait for, that is sufficient to do it. And this is not intuitive because, you know, it's, you know, this is a way you might draw this scenario, right, that we're, to show that there's that circular dependency, but it's a lot less, you know, straightforward. because we have this kind of divisible resource. So we've looked at some gridlock, and I'm going to go next into kind of more formally defining gridlock, so with the goal of looking at how can we make sure we avoid it. And we're going to apply several ways for avoiding gridlock to a very synthetic example in the lab of the dining philosopher's problem. And the reason we're using this is we want to have an example of a gridlock that involves more than two threads, and this is relatively easy to think about the gridlock, even though it's very synthetic. So I'm going to show you what that problem is. And in the lab next week, your assignment is basically going to be to implement several of the techniques for proactively avoiding gridlock that we're going to talk about. And the dining philosopher's problem is designed to kind of construct that kind of multiple thread circular dependency. And to illustrate it, so we have five philosophers eating at a round table here, and they're going to use chopsticks to eat, and we've placed five chopsticks, and five chopsticks is enough for two philosophers to eat at a time. Seems plenty. But when our philosophers aren't eating, they're patient, they can think for a while. So they're going to follow this algorithm here to start eating. They're going to pick up the chopstick on their left, and then they're going to pick up the chopstick on their right. And if they just decide independently to eat, this works fine. But if they happen to do this all at the same time, everyone picks up their left chopstick and looks at their right, and there's no chopstick there. And this is a gridlock, in this case, with five threads, where each philosopher represents a thread. And kind of our conceptual assumption is that the philosophers are infinitely patient, so they'll just sit here forever. So we'll have a representation of this with sort of blocks representing the chopsticks, and this is just to like have the least overhead for showing a gridlock situation that we can resolve with one of the several techniques we'll talk about. Okay, so let's kind of more formally define what gridlock means. So gridlock is circular waiting for resources, and a resource is just something a thread needs to do its work. So we've talked about the examples of locks or memory. We could also have gridlocks with all sorts of other resources, like disk space or CPU time. We mentioned that this is often non-deterministic. Now, to more formally figure out when does gridlock happen, because like how could it happen with CPU time, let's talk about the requirements for how that resource is managed and used to make gridlock happen. And we can kind of formally define gridlock with these four requirements. So one requirement we need is we need mutual exclusion. We need that only one thread at a time can actually use the resource. So for example, if I have a console that I'm outputting to, and every thread can output to the console equally well, there's no possibility of a gridlock, because there's no contention for accessing the console. Everyone can do it, everyone can print things at the same time, no problem. We also need hold and wait. That if I have one lock in my entire program and no other things I hold, then I can't have a gridlock because I need to have a second lock. So I hold one lock and wait for another. If I have only one resource, there's no hold and wait. We also need there to be no preemption of resources. So this is why usually our idea of CPU time, like time on the processor, can't trigger a deadlock, because in most consumer OSs, if my processor is on the CPU, it doesn't get to stay on the CPU forever. Even if it's waiting for something else, it gets preempted. Something else gets to run. So in order to have deadlock, we need to have this property that the resources are only released voluntarily. If we involuntarily take the processor's resource, like scheduling something else on the CPU, there's no possibility for a deadlock with that resource. And we saw we had this with locks because it seems pretty hard to just tell a thread, yeah, you got that lock, but not really anymore. I'm going to take it from you. And then we need circular wait, and I mentioned that circular wait, we saw like the simple example just involved two threads. It can involve kind of an arbitrarily large number of threads. We just need that sequence where thread one's waiting on two, waiting on three, waiting on four, waiting on up to n, and n waiting on one. We just need to find any sequence like that. That's enough for a deadlock. And the reason I'm going over this kind of rather formal definition of a deadlock is that to think about how we proactively prevent deadlocks, we can think about how can we attack each of these parts of the definition. And we'll have different techniques for different parts, and which ones will make the most sense are going to depend on what kind of resource we're talking about in practice. But now that we've kind of formally defined deadlock, let's go through, thinking about when does it happen. And here I have an example of, I have a linked list where each node of the linked list has a lock. And this might kind of naively seem like a good design, but as this example illustrates, it's probably not something you should do. And I have a remove node method here. And the way it works is that, let's say we're calling remove node on C. In that case, we're going to lock C, then we're going to lock C's previous item, which is B, then we're going to lock D. And presumably the reason for this order is that I need to lock C to read the next and pre pointers because I want to make sure they're not being changed by like some other call to remove node before I access them. And then I can access the next and pre pointers. And the question is, let's say we're running remove node for multiple threads at the same time, which combinations can deadlock? I have a bunch of options here. So I'll give you some time to work over that and think of which answer here, which combination answer is the best. we'd like some more time? Let's start with who thinks the answer is A, meaning that it's just A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. Okay, so we have a bit of a split. So I think the best answer is D. So something you'll note is that kind of A implies C and B implies C, because if B and C cause a deadlock, then we can have the same deadlock happen, and D happens to be running off on its own, not hanging. But that still means we have a deadlock, and the same will be true in B and D. Now, there's might be in the case of C, there might be new deadlocks that we don't see in A and B that involve more threads, but we also have the original one, so that's sufficient to answer the question. And for proving that A has a deadlock, I can just give an example that if we can have this timeline that I lock B from removing B, then I lock its previous, which is kind of irrelevant here, then I try to lock C. And when I try to lock C, well, that's something that C needs to lock, so it could be the case that C has already locked that, and after it tries to lock that, it wants to lock B, and we can have this timeline where it's trying to lock B while I'm trying to lock C, and we're both waiting for each other. We have our circular wait between the two threads, and that would be a deadlock. Now, then there's the question, which is the much harder part of this question, is how do we prove that we can't have a deadlock with just B and D? So I'm gonna go through one way of, I guess, well, sorry, do you have a voluntary answer?
Whoever grabs C will be able to
see. Okay, so one option, so one way you can think about this is that your notion is whoever grabs C is the one who's going to be able to proceed. And a way we can see this is, let's just write down what the lock operations for these are. So for B, we're going to lock B, then we're going to lock A, then C, and for D, we're going to lock C, and then we're going to lock B, or not, sorry, then we're going to lock, for D, we're going to lock, sorry, for D, we're going to lock D, then we're going to lock C, and then E. Something we can, one way we can simplify this analysis is we can say, well, if these are the only two threads running, then the only way we can have a deadlock involving just them, where the cycle involves just them, means that they have to have both threads care about the things that are in that cycle, right? If we want to have our the B-thread, and we want B-thread, and we want to have, this type of loop, D-thread, we need to have some objects in common involved in that loop. And I can tell, actually, that the lock of B is irrelevant, that yes, we might be locking B, but that's either going to be a line to a resource from the B thread or from a resource from the B thread that there's no lines from D to or from. So that's irrelevant to whether we have a cycle, because the B lock, no other thread involved in our analysis is using. And the same is true with the lock of D, the lock of A, and the lock of E. So the only locks we need to consider are the lock of C. And if we only have one lock, then we don't have hold and wait anymore. Remember, we need to be holding one lock and acquiring another. If we only acquire one lock, we aren't holding a lock while acquiring another, holding a resource while acquiring another. And so that's sufficient to show that that scenario doesn't result in deadlock. And kind of a key thing there is that, like, there's an intuition that, oh, we're locking the same thing, and that's true. That's not sufficient to create deadlock. It's necessary, but it's not a sufficient condition. We need to have that cycle created somehow, and we can't have a cycle with just one thing between two threads. I guess I will say that you might argue that there is the trivial case of deadlock where if I write code that like locks the same thing twice, some people would argue that's a deadlock. I'm going to kind of dodge whether that's a deadlock and just call that a weird special case. But arguably that meets our definition here for a deadlock where the circular weight involves one thread. But it's not really an interesting deadlock, and not usually the ones we're concerned about preventing, because that scenario, yes, it happens sometimes, but it's relatively easy to prevent. Where this is one thread does this, lock it twice. Okay, so we talked about our definition of deadlock, and now let's apply this to come up with sort of ways we can avoid deadlock. So one thing we can attack is the mutual exclusion idea. So if we make sure that we have enough resources, that threads never need to take turns, that's a way of avoiding deadlock. That doesn't really work with our like directories with a lock, because we can't really have like a separate directory for every thread. The whole point is that it's the same directory, because that's what makes directories useful. So that you don't have like every application gets its own directory, and now your files are split across tons of new directories. But for some applications, like thinking about the allocating memory case, this can actually solve the problem. Or if we like think about compute time, if we have two processors and two programs, well, we can never have contention, for that. And that gets us to having no shared resources. If there isn't sharing, no problem. Or if there's enough, there's no problem. So those work for some special cases, particularly those deadlocks like involving disk space or memory, right? This might be how you'd solve the problem. But often we're dealing with resources where, kind of the fundamental nature of things means we have to look for another solution. So another strategy is to attack either the hold or wait property or the no preemption property, or never giving up resources. So one idea we can have for that is that we can say, rather than waiting for another resource, we're going to say, well, if I can't get it right now, I'm going to give up and retry. And pthreads actually provide support for doing this kind of thing, what they call pthread mutex trilock. And this, rather than waiting, will tell you, hey, the lock's not available right now. And this indeed is like enough to solve our deadlock problem. So here's an example of using that for our move file example, that I get the from directory lock, then I try to get the to directory lock, and if I can't get it, I'm going to unlock the from directory lock because I want to break a deadlock. If there's a deadlock, someone's waiting for me, you know, potentially to release the from directory lock, so let's do that now so they can hopefully make progress, because they might be holding the to lock, and I definitely want them to not hold it anymore. So I unlock it, and then I retry. And this gets rid of the deadlock, but it can create a new problem, which is called live lock. So this isn't deadlock because we're not hanging, but it's not useful. We can just have the timing work out over and over again that we keep, you know, trying to get the lock and it doesn't work because the other thread is also like retrying to get the lock, and you know, that's not useful. So that doesn't mean you can't use this kind of give up the lock and retry to get it strategy. But you want to take some measures to avoid live lock. The idea we're going to have you do in the lab is that rather than immediately retrying, we're going to wait some random amount of time intended to make sure that the threads are not precisely in sync. And typically, the way you do this is you'd wait a small random amount of time, and if that doesn't work, you wait a larger and larger, because that handles what if there are like 50 threads doing this. Waiting larger amounts of times makes it less and less likely you're in sync with any of those other 49 threads. And there's other things you could do if you're more sophisticated, like if you like had a database doing this, you might have like a detector for are we doing live lock now, and might like have a special mode where you actually make the threads take turns in that case, or something like that. So that's on our abort and retry idea. So another idea we might have in the no waiting camp is that to revoke or preempt resources. And this is actually the strategy we use for preventing deadlocks with the processor on our typical OSs, that if my program needs the processor now before some other program can use the processor, why don't we have deadlock there? Well, because my program can't keep the processor forever. That I can try, but it's going to be taken from me to run something else. Right, we have our time multiplexing. And we can also imagine doing this for locks, and that is in fact something that is relatively common in databases. That databases will relatively commonly have a way of say having a thread that has a lock and say, you have to give up your lock. But to make that work, we need to do a bunch of extra bookkeeping to like undo the thing the thread was in the middle of doing. Because if we just like take away the lock, it's as if we didn't do locking, and that would result in all sorts of race conditions where like all our account balances are wrong. So kind of like the code pattern that would be used in some database like that would be, we might imagine that there's some way of like triggering an exception while we're doing something with the lock. And when that happens, we will undo the operation and release the lock. And this, you know, gives us a way of avoiding deadlock by, when there would be a deadlock, we just take the thread that we would be waiting for and make it stop being something we're waiting for, at the cost of that thread's going to need to redo the operation. This is another case where, like in our kind of try locking and retry if it doesn't work, where we could run into this live lock problem where we don't have a hanging situation, but we have the arguably worse problem of we're keeping trying to do something and never actually finishing it. So this no waiting idea, I think, is most straightforward, but has some real problems in implementation because of live lock and things like that. So what almost everyone tries to do with locks, in cases where you can practically do it, is attack the circular wait property. And we can do this by acquiring resources in a consistent order. So what that might look like for our move file example is that rather than acquiring the from lock and the to lock, I'm going to choose an ordering. In this case, I'm choosing a lexicographic ordering of the directory names, but I could choose any ordering I want. And the idea is if we think of our two threads, that I'm, that if we're doing A and B and B and A, we're always going to do A then B. So I'm going to have, always going to either have, be trying to acquire A, or have acquired A before I acquire B. And the same would be true of any other thread. We can't make a cycle that way. We can't make a circle if we all have the same ordering. In order for there to be a circle in this graph, we need to have some case where we're not going in order. So if we always go in order, that prevents the scenario. And as I mentioned, any ordering will do. We just need to have everyone who uses the locks follow that order. And this avoids all the problems of like, what about how, how fast do we retry or anything like that? And therefore, generally the most practical way of avoiding deadlock. You might say, why aren't databases doing this? Well, if you've used SQL, you know that databases kind of let you specify the order you access things in that way. That makes it kind of not practical for them to apply this technique. But in most of our programs, we can carefully specify the order we access things in, and this will therefore be the most viable strategy to avoid deadlock. Proactively, we don't need to do any extra work other than choosing an order and making sure we follow it. Questions about this consistent ordering idea? So if you look at a large multi-threaded code base, often you'll see them using this strategy. And as an example, in the Linux kernel, they just document the lock order for this reason. This is how they're avoiding deadlock. Is they say, this code, we have a whole bunch of different locks here. And what you should do is you should get the LDT user sem first, then the mmap sem, then the context.lock. And here you should get the slab mutex first, then the list lock for the node, and then the slab lock for the page. Like that's the order we always use in this code. And that's how they're avoiding deadlock, is that they're choosing an order, documenting it, and making sure everyone who writes code that deals with these data structures follows the same order, so we can't have a deadlock. Questions? Yes. Okay. So another strategy, another way of attacking our hold and wait problem is, previously I attacked the wait side of hold and wait. We can also attack the hold part of hold and wait and just get the resources all at once. So in move file, it would be really nice if we had a mutex lock many, where we could lock A's lock and B's lock at the same time. Right, that would solve our problem. And we can actually simulate that. And that's just what we're going to have you do for the lab. by just sort of lock a global lock. So we make sure we take turns acquiring any set of locks, then lock the A lock, then lock B, and then we can unlock the global lock, because the purpose of this kind of global lock is just to make sure that we take turns acquiring locks. If we do that, we don't have any case where we're holding a lock and waiting for another. We're either going to get all the locks together, or we're not. We're not going to be holding a lock, you know, while you're waiting for a lock. You're going to only wait for a lock. We're going to take turns waiting for locks. So only one thread waits for locks at a time under this scheme. And in some cases, this is a fairly easy strategy. Another way you can think of this of manifesting in real applications is if we think of our linked list, like kind of the part of the problem was we had a separate lock for each node. At the cost of the ability to do things at the same time, we could have one lock for the linked list. We could acquire that with one lock operation. That would avoid deadlock, because we're getting the resources all at once. We'd have a real cost in that we wouldn't be able to access different parts of the linked list at the same time. But, you know, that's probably better than deadlocking. Some questions? Okay, so that's kind of my conclusion on deadlock. So for the lab, you're going to do this strategy with that kind of idea of a global lock to make us take turns acquiring locks so we don't have multiple threads doing that at once, our consistent order, and this busy signal idea. Okay, so in our next 10 minutes, we're going to go back to something I alluded to earlier when we talked about barriers, which is that barriers weren't the only thing we wanted to do that went beyond what locks let us do. And I promise we have kind of a very generic way of having threads wait for an event to happen. So barriers are a special case of this, where the event is a bunch of threads are done doing something. We're going to want something more generic. And we're going to talk about monitors. Monitors are one of the sort of general ways of coordinating threads. They're the one I'm going to focus on because I think it's the easier to understand. There's also semaphores can do all the same things. I'm going to teach monitors because I think they're easier to understand. And the big thing that we're going to have with monitors are this new idea called a condition variable. And while I think monitors are kind of easier to understand than some of the alternatives, condition variables is a really unhelpful name. Because you look at the name condition variables and you're going to say, oh, right, so it must have like a boolean in it. And no, it doesn't. A condition variable, despite the name, is a list of waiting threads. And I say, why is it called a condition variable? Because it represents traditionally threads that are all waiting for the same thing, the same condition. But it's just a list of waiting threads. And the operations it supports are about changing what's on that list. So we have something representing a list of waiting threads. We're going to combine that with the locks we've already seen and some data, and we'll call the combination a monitor. And the original kind of introduction of monitors was meant for an object-oriented language. So traditionally, these monitors have been represented as an actual object that has instance variables and a lock and some condition variables, meaning list of threads that are waiting for things about the object. And in fact, in Java, every object is a monitor. Java gives every object a lock and a condition variable. Even if you don't ask for it, it's there. Bthreads doesn't use this type of design because C isn't an object-oriented language. So Bthreads just gives you kind of raw access to the condition variable, and you kind of assemble your own monitor, because there's not like an object to put it in, you make the object yourself. But we'll call the combination a monitor, and this is going to be how we coordinate threads and pretty much, you know, to do whatever we want to do as far as when the threads run, what they wait for, and we'll have some very specific examples probably next week. So our monitor, and I have something that if you've taken a class where you've seen UML, kind of roughly sort of looks like a UML diagram, kind of deliberately because of that object-oriented idea. We have a lock, and we're going to follow a convention, because that before we access any of the monitor stuff, any of this object stuff, including our shared data, and any of our condition variables, any of our list of waiting threads, we always acquire the lock, meaning that we only have one thread at a time manipulating the state of this monitor. So each of these operations here is going to acquire the lock before they touch all that data. And we have a lock, and conceptually we can think of the lock as having a list of waiting threads that are waiting to get the lock. And while we hold the lock, those threads are just waiting, and when we unlock the lock, we take one of those threads and let it run. And our condition variables are additional list of waiting threads, but they're not waiting for us to release the lock, they're waiting for something to happen with that, based on that list. But it's a list of threads waiting for, as we'll see, some condition to be true. And our condition variable is going to provide three operations. So it's a list of threads. One thing we need to do is add to the list. And the way that's going to work is that if I'm on a thread that wants to add myself to the list, I can call this wait operation. When I call wait, I add myself to the list of that condition variable. And the idea is that at that point, I'm waiting, I'm not going to run anymore until something takes me off the list for the condition variable. And so you see that this wait operation takes a lock, because something we need to do is we want to make sure we only manipulate the list of waiting threads, these condition variables, with the lock held, because that was our policy for the monitor. We take turns manipulating the state. But if I want to start waiting, I want to give up the lock so other threads can do stuff. So to enable that, the wait operation takes both the condition variable to add ourselves to and the lock that makes sure we take turns accessing it, and it will simultaneously add us to the list of waiting threads and release that lock. And when wait returns, it will take back the lock. We'll make sure we have access again. It's exclusive. So before it returns, not only won't we be on the list of waiting threads anymore, but we'll have the lock again so we can safely manipulate the shared data of the monitor. So that's adding a thread to the list of waiting threads. How do we remove threads? Well, we have two operations for that. One is called broadcast. So this takes a list of waiting threads and makes them all not be waiting anymore. But when they're not waiting on that condition variable, they're not waiting for something to be true, they still need to run. And we know what they need to do before they run is they need to have the lock to access the shared data, because everyone takes turns accessing that. So conceptually, what the broadcast operation does is it takes the threads that were previously waiting for us to notify them and makes them start waiting for the lock. And then when the lock is next unlocked, they might get a chance to run. And eventually, they should all get a chance to run once we go through everything that needs a turn, looking at the shared data. We also have a special signal operation where we choose arbitrarily one of the threads that's on that list of waiting threads, let it run, and by let it run, I mean we have it wait for the lock to access the show data. Next. Questions about my our condition variable operations? Yeah.
So the signal you is arbitrary, so you can't say remove the first one off the queue.
So the question is, for signal, it's arbitrary, so I can't say remove the first one off the queue. Yes. So if you want a specific order, probably the easiest way of doing that is to have a separate condition variable for each thread. And it's permissible to make an array or a linked list of condition variables. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you give an example of
when you want to use signal? Can I give an example when I want to use signal? I will have one next time. The most common, the short version of it is, if I've added something to a queue, only one, and threads need to get something from the queue, signal makes more sense than broadcast because only one thread can do anything based on that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So I'll give my simple example, simple in the sense of simpler than your future examples, of using pthreadconT. So I have my monitor here. This is my lock. This is my shared data. And I have a condition variable that's the list of threads that are waiting for finished, the shared data, to be set to true. And I have two operations. I have wait for finished and finish. And wait for finished, I get the lock to make sure we're taking turns accessing the shared data. I check if the finish flag is true. And if it's not, I add myself to the list of threads waiting for it to be true. If it is true already, I don't do anything, I don't need to wait. And when I start waiting, that releases the lock automatically, which lets some other thread actually set the finish flag to true. And when it sets the finish flag to true, it calls broadcast to make sure anyone who is waiting for finish to be true now gets to go. So we'll look at this more next time. You have like kind of one of the possible timelines or another. And we'll also answer next time the question of why did I write while here? That's not if error. We have to put while there and not if, and we'll talk about why next time.